It's The Pastor's Heart and Dominic Steele and Growth and Change with Andrew Hird. Next week on The Pastor's Heart, we're speaking to our friend Archie Poulos on 10 books you must read in 2024. But let me make a prediction. Just as Chris Watkins' book was a must-read book for 2023, for a whole lot of different reasons, Andrew Hird's about-to-be-released book, Growth and Change, will be the must-read book for pastors for 2024. It's available for pre-order. The link is in the show notes. In his opening preface, the theologian, the founder of the Gospel Coalition, Don Carson, said, amongst other things, "I am usually loath to proclaim that such and such a book is the best in its field, but if there is one book that happily serves as the exception to the rule, Hird's book is it." My comment is that this is a book I'm about to buy a copy of as a present for those leaders in our church that I want to encourage, for I think it's going to do our church a power of good. Andrew Hird is with us. Andrew, can we talk first your pastor's heart? For it is your heart for pastors that caused you to write this book.
Oh, absolutely. And for the cause of the gospel across the country.
Yeah.
So it's my heart for seeing Australia and the world one for Christ. That's the big driver.
Mm. You talk about, growth. You're saying, I'm the problem, I'm the blockage of growth. But then you immediately start with recognizing there is a danger in us having a passion for growth.
Yeah. One of the first chapters of the book is the danger of having a passion for growth. Oh, absolutely. The more passionate we are about seeing the church grow, through conversion growth, of course, the more passionate we are about seeing that happen, the more prone, open we are to compromise, to saying what needs to be said to gather the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I think very importantly, people have noted that growth statistics are very blunt instruments, but in our desire to see growth happen, we can just be captured by that simple dynamic and end up saying what people want to hear. And so the first thing that I want to tackle is there is a great danger in pursuing this thing. We need to be alert to it. But the converse of that isn't therefore just a place safe.
Mm. Just on that danger, as I read that chapter, I thought, we had a university lecturer come to our church and she left another church. And her reason was that they hadn't spoken on sexuality. And it was a new church plant with a younger pastor, and they'd avoided all the hard topics for the 5 years that she'd been there.
Yeah.
And she was troubled by what she could see was the trajectory.
Yeah,
And I thought, that's what Andrew's critiquing.
All the hot topics, see. But one of them particularly, of course, is sin. rebellion, sin, hostility towards God, the human heart, what's happening. And so, the centrality of God, materialism, greed, this worldliness. There's all kinds of topics that we won't even notice we're not speaking on because we actually want to be liked. There's a danger and tendency to want to be liked, appreciated. I need to grow this church. So all of that builds a pressure towards me being consumer-driven, sinner-driven.
You don't go into this in the book, but how do you at EV intentionally run towards those complex areas?
One of the great things is to have a team ministry.
Yeah.
Because having people around you helps you be alert to your blind spots and your fears and insecurities and uncertainties. But certainly what I'm doing is I'm watching my own reactions. I'm alert to overreactions, underreactions, so that I can be, I see the text is drawing attention to this issue. Is there something in me that might make me hesitant to speak to interrogate that, find out what's happening, and then make an informed decision about whether to speak or not speak? And so just being alert to what's happening for us as preachers. It is very interesting. You can exegete a passage, you can go through and prepare a sermon and be unaware of what you bring to that task and how it influences what you see matters from the passage. And the more you can learn yourself and see what goes on in your own heart, the better you're able to analyze that predisposition, confirmation bias, groupthink, all of those issues that we need to pay attention to. And I'm also, one of the things I do often work at is Identifying what the hot issues are, what are the issues I might be tempted not to speak about, and stepping towards them.
Mm-hmm.
So intentionally taking on the difficult topics. So from the very beginning, 27 years ago at EV, we began a thing called Hot Topics.
Mm-hmm.
And so three, four times a year, we've always chosen one of those topics that I think is difficult for us to engage mm-hmm. with, and made a whole event of it. And that, for mine, is a discipline as a leader and as a church to keep stepping into the difficult things.
So what have been your last few hot topics?
Oh, we did critical race theory last year sometime. We've done transgender, abortion, euthanasia. These are probably the last 12 to 18 months,
yep.
The topics we've picked up. But prior to that, you know, we picked up some topics on creationism, mm-hmm. 6 to 8 creation, long earth, because that was a particular topic that was emerging around our church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've picked up Catholicism mm-hmm. And so on and so forth, yeah.
Cool. We won't change things that need to be changed until the pain of not changing is greater than the pain of changing.
Yeah. A very fundamental principle of human life. I won't tackle the diet issue until I'm brought to face the fact that if I don't, it's a very great problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because change is painful. Any change is costly and difficult. And in Christian ministry, churches form a kind of self-sealing model where people join a church given the way it's shaped and patterned and operates, and they come into that cultural context and find safety in it and don't want it to be changed because their whole identity ends up being formed by it. So any change threatens people within the institutional congregational setting. So to bring about change is actually pushing against all kinds of deep and profound things. To bring about change in church is very, very painful. And if you don't feel the pain of not changing, you won't buy into that pain. And change often not only brings about pain in the immediate, it takes to bring about real change is a long project. And you won't have the personal will or institutional will to pursue the change over the long haul if you're not thoroughly bought into the need for it mm-hmm. and committed to it.
Mm.
And so one of the big things in the book is what I'm trying to do in part, and part of what I'm trying to do in all my ministry actually, is build a heat, a discontent,
mm.
an anxiety and worry around the lostness of the lost. I think the more I feel the pain of the people who are not coming to our church, the more I feel the pain of the community around me and the fact they're going to hell,
mm-hmm.
the more I feel that pain, the more I'm empowered to bite the bullet and embrace the pain of change with the people I've got here.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problem too is that the pain of change happens with the people in my immediate vicinity. I feel and see their pain,
mm.
But until I can feel and see the invisible pain of those outside of me, I won't buy into the pain of those in front of me. So there's a whole, this is the heart piece of mm. what I talk about. I think for church leadership, until we have a burning ambition to see God's name glorified and honoured, and a burning ambition to see the lost saved, we will slide into practices and patterns of ministries that will become detrimental to the work without noticing it.
Yeah. Now, as I read that in your book, I thought there's an immediate application for what I'm doing locally in our church, but there's also a prophetic word to our network, to yeah. the denomination. And I thought back to our synod debate last year, and there's a whole lot of rectors saying we're in pain in the synod debate and we're struggling and evangelism is hard. And then others, and perhaps they weren't the, if you like, the frontline people, were saying, it's not so bad. Look over here, there's not a problem. Yeah.
Yeah, I find myself distressed deeply. I wasn't in the debate. I don't know what's going mm-hmm. on. So just be cautious, of course. I want to keep making those caveats. The I feel the same thing with the discussion around the soil.
We had David Reekfield a couple of weeks ago in the Pastor's Heart saying, I mean, you talked about head, heart and hand being a problem in Sydney.
Yeah.
Whereas he said, actually, I want to say yes to that, but also there's a soil problem.
Yeah, look, there always has been. Jesus in the parable of the soils, you know, there's always been a soil issue. There's been the soil that receives it. There's been the soil that's, you know, hardened against it. There's always been that problem. We live outside the garden. Sin, Satan, the world has always been our issue. Certainly Satan in his schemes puts different bait on the hook, and we need to be alert to that. And insofar as people like David help us be aware to the different flavour and shape of sin and the difficulties, yes. But when we discuss the issues of the soil, which I've noticed the last 15 years seems to be a heightened interest, mm-hmm. but when we discuss the issue of the soil, it's one thing to recognise the context we're in and the difficulties mm-hmm. that brings. Absolutely right. It's what you do with it next that matters fundamentally. And if I could offer an analogy, I talked to a couple or a number of couples whose kids are growing up into teenage years and drifting away from the faith.
Mm-hmm.
They're losing their faith. I can point out to them quite rightly that there's a certain percentage through the last generations of Christian, Western Christian society where the kids have given up the faith. In America, it's something like two-thirds. So historically, the last few decades, two-thirds of Christian kids in homes give up the faith. I can point out that the dynamic there is driven in large measure by the soil, that our kids are swimming in a world that's difficult, the culture's against them and so on and so forth. All of that's true. But what I do with that next is telling. If the next thing I do is, therefore, don't worry about it, we ought not be anxious about it, then that is deeply concerning. Because, well, firstly, to tell a parent 60% give up the faith, don't worry, it's a thing that happens.
Mm.
They say, this is my child, he's going to hell.
Yeah, I care.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. To point out the soil is difficult, and churches rise and fall, and that's a cultural movement, and we're at a particular time now, and we just need to, and it may come back again. All of that may be true, except right at the moment, our churches are unable to reach people going to hell.
Mm.
And if churches are declining at the moment, whatever the causes, I want to do whatever I can to bring about change that might help it be changed.
Hmm.
I can't sit back and say, don't worry, don't be anxious, it comes and goes. We're talking about heaven and hell here.
Hmm.
And particularly for Sydney, if Sydney churches are in decline, then not only is that just a terrible tragedy, that means people around us are not hearing the life-saving gospel and being brought to faith. Churches are potentially being ineffective. Sydney has the resource that almost no one else can get.
Mm.
You at present have property and facilities in parts of the city that we can't get into. And if there are churches in the context of expensive real estate that are underperforming, have a series of blockages that could be changed if we could just get in and fix things, and they're simply not reaching their communities, we can't blame the soil simply and leave it at that and just say, it's what happens. We've got to get in and do something because it's heaven and hell at stake.
Mm.
Yeah. How can we notice these things and not be deeply distressed and fall on our knees and plead with God to bring about whatever change needs to happen? And I might, get me started, I might add too, brother, that God does his best work in the times when the soil's the hardest. Do you know, the great revivals didn't occur because sociologically there was factors that occurred that meant it should have happened. Our great revivals have happened in the context where it's been the bleakest of times. The churches have been at their weakest. And it happened because God raised up men and women with a heart for the lost, with a passion that meant they wouldn't be content with the state of things as they were. They were determined to do whatever it took. They'd step out into the fields and preach if it needed to happen. They'd break the parish system if that's what needed to happen. They did whatever it took under God, according to the law of Christ, and so on and so forth. But there was an urgency about them, and I fear we don't have that urgency.
Mm. Yeah. Mission is the primary task of the church between Christ's coming and his return. You say that on page 58, you're quoting O'Brien and Kostenberger, that we need to be serious about mission. Now, that's really just what you were saying just a moment ago. But, I mean, again, I was to speak to a current debate. I'll give you a quote from Simon Flinders' address at the Anglican Church League dinner in last year. I want to put to you the idea that the local church has a primarily missional purpose is an idea that is hard to find in the pages of the New Testament. And when we speak as if this is its purpose, I worry that we confuse church and gospel. What I mean is that it's the gospel which is the primary agent of God's mission in the world and not the local church. And I worry too that when we think and speak like this, we become foggy in our thinking about church in ways that might have a number of unhelpful implications, because church is not merely a means to an end, but a glorious end itself.
Yeah. And you want me to react?
Well, I've read a senior leader like Simon Flinders say something, a senior leader, as I've been reading your book, like Andrew Hurd, say something, and they seem to me to be pushing in entirely different directions.
Yeah. I think it is a wonderful truth that we need to contend for, which is that the church gathering has its primacy around for the believer. You know, church is a wonderful end in itself. It's the fruit of the gospel. People are one to faith to be gathered around Christ and his word, to gather, to give voice to the victory of the cross, to adore their God, our God, who has brought us together, and to edify. That is certainly at the heart of the purposes of church, the gathering. A couple of things to draw attention to. I think Kostenberger and O'Brien are particularly thinking about the church as the people of God. I think they're using the language a little bit more broadly. But nonetheless, if the gathering is about edification for the believer, then what is edification about except forming Christ in us?
Mm-hmm.
Edification is about forming me to be like Jesus. What is Jesus like? He is the one who left his throne above to, at great cost, take on flesh, become one of us. For what purpose? To seek and save the lost. The Father loved so much that he did not spare his only Son, but gave him up for us all. To be more and more like Christ, to be edified and built up into the image of Jesus, is to become someone more and more captured and passionate about the cause of the gospel going out. And so, if church is to edify, then what I ought to see happen in church is a growing passion and vigor and fire and energy for the lost. How can someone who's leading that ministry, who himself is captivated by the mission for the lost, lead that gathering of people without a regard to maximizing its ability to reach the lost as well? And here's what I would contend, that it's possible to do both end. And why wouldn't you if you're a pastor with a passion for the lost? That is to say, I think, well, the question for us perhaps to put it like this, is it possible to maintain the central fundamental concern of the gathering as for edification of believers and yet still maximize its ability to reach outsiders? If it's possible to do both end whilst keeping one central and fundamental foundation, if it's possible to maximize its impact for mission, why wouldn't we? Why would we argue against that when all around us, thousands of people are lost and going to hell?
Mm.
And so that's our question. Is it either or can it be both end whilst maintaining? But having said that about the gathering, I think we need to do everything we can to maximize the gathering's usefulness and impact for the cause of the gospel. Our singing is at one and the same time adoring our God, edifying one another, and I think, as Tony Payne says, advertising to the unbeliever.
Mm.
The gospel word that we preach that seeks to edify is the same word that saves.
Mm.
How can we not function in our gatherings like that? But more, once you operate it as a gathering that's captivated by the cause of the gospel, and so maximizing its opportunities for mission as well as edification at the center, I want to then, as a community of faith, be building up this community to have a heart for the lost and a passion to see the world saved.
And a structural plan to do it.
And then the question comes, you see, here's the head, heart, hand. If my head has worked through the issues of either or, both and, those kinds of just theological questions that need to be wrestled with quite rightly, I've worked through the head issues. I've got a heart issue that I can't, I come to Jerusalem and I weep over the city. I come to sit and I weep over it. If I've got a heart for the lost like that, I will be maximizing everything I can, and then I'll be working out a plan. Then I'll be, I can't just expect things to be different in its outcome if I don't do anything different on the input side of things. I can't just want more people to be saved and not change anything.
Now, let's come to outputs and inputs, as you just alluded to, because you had a whole chapter on that, and it's super helpful. And you're saying, I think, many of us, as we organise our ministries, we're thinking lots and lots about the inputs, and we're not thinking enough about what the outputs are and defining the outputs. Can you just give me that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the big shifts that needs to occur is a shift from input leadership to output leadership. So, much of this is the attention of the book, and so I haven't got, obviously, there's more nuance that needs to be said. Inputs are those things that I do to go into a system or an organisational life to produce outcomes. Teach.
I mean, I just remember.
To produce education.
I was under high pressure. And what do? I've just been sued. And how do I? I just thought, what have I got to do? Preach the word in season and out of season. I've got to do the work of an evangelist. If I do that, I can get through the week.
And there's an appropriate commitment to inputs.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, we need to do that in season and out of season. But we need to do. I'm offering one of the challenges I put in the book is that we need to shift from just being focused on inputs. To recognizing what's the difference that those inputs are meant to achieve. What's the outcome I'm seeking to achieve from those inputs? And the outcome, I want to argue, of course, is to make disciples, to bring people to faith and grow them into mature disciples of Christ. And the more we're focused on achieving that outcome, the more we can be equipped and enabled to assess all that we're doing on the input side of things to ensure that they maximise the potential for the outcomes.
But you're actually, I mean, you're wanting us to be sharper than that. You're wanting to say, I want to see 10 people converted or whatever it is.
If all we can achieve at the very first
or one outset person converted,
Perhaps so, yes. But I just want us to shift to actually caring about making a difference.
Right,
yeah. And not just turning the wheels of our ministries. That's the fundamental paradigm shift I want. But yeah, I would want to raise questions around if we've been running a ministry for 10 years and not seen the outcome of a convert, that should raise questions for us. Now, yes, there are extreme circumstances in the stream soil where, it's not a surprise that perhaps no one's been converted, all of these. But that's not Sydney. That's not our cultural context. We might want to keep telling ourselves it is to get us off the hook and not worry. But, brother, we're seeing lots of people converted in ministries in this same exact place. And so some churches are seeing it, some not. What's happening with those that aren't? Let's ask those questions and wrestle with it, because too much is at stake.
You spoke about the outcomes in sermons, and rather than me just doing something that was exegetically faithful, me having an outcome that was exegetically faithful and landed in people's lives.
It's a very telling question to wrestle together with a preacher on what they're seeking to achieve with this sermon. What difference do they hope that this 30-40 minute time will make in the lives of people? And if we're unclear about that as preachers, teachers, then it's very unlikely that the outcome will be achieved. This is just the way things operate, isn't it? If I think my task is to simply be faithful to saying everything the passage says, then you will preach differently to the person who says the outcome of this preaching is to transform and change the life of this person for eternity.
Mm.
The outcome of this sermon is to achieve this thing. You'll preach differently.
Mm.
You'll be sharper. You'll plead with. You'll have the New Testament tone of urgency.
Mm.
Do you know where God, Romans, God comes and he holds out his hands to Israel and pleads with them, beseeches them. Jesus beseeches. You've got this different tone in the preaching that needs to be flavoring. We need more blood earnestness in our preaching rather than just an exercise in comprehension and commentary, debate and discussion.
Mm-hmm.
We need preachers who are prophets who stand and declare the word of God to achieve repentance and faith.
Yeah. You had a quote from Paul Grimmond in the book there that they had proclamation workshops. As one colleague described the groups, it's like they got their exegesis spot on, then closed their eyes, fired an arrow randomly in the air, opened their eyes to see where it landed, and said, that looks like a good place to do application.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got a lot of work to do. Yeah. I think what Paul is recognizing is there are other pieces of our work that need lots of work. And just to have said true and faithful things is not the same as bringing a wisdom to the task that means the activity has a greater, under God, by his grace, potential to make a difference. I think it's 1 Corinthians 14 in a sense where, you know, the Apostle Paul talks about edification requiring intelligibility.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's possible to say true things, but in ways that aren't intelligible to the cultural context within which I'm ministering. And so that requires some insight and some wisdom to ensure that this part of the Bible is made intelligible in a way that bites, that captivates, that captures. That's a lifetime progress.
Mm.
You don't work that out in 12 months. But if you have a heart for transformation, if you have a heart for outcomes, change lives, you'll make it a life ambition to be better at it, to work out how I can make this task as effective as it possibly can be.
Let's just come back to leading through change. And you talk about there being a difference between the way secular business leaders see. They go into an organization, they see the needs to be changed, they say, let's do it, and 6-12 months later, there is change.
Yeah.
And yet, you're saying it's the pastor sees the problem but then isn't able to do it? Or
It's head, heart, hand. The pastor might see a problem. It might be identified. Here's six things that if you made these changes, it would help. But there's various things that happen for the pastor that create a system that resists change being operated. In the corporate setting, here's six things that will make your business more profitable.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that makes it a powerful imperative, an incentive to change, is the conviction that the business leader's actions are directly tied to the outcome. The reason your profit is low is because of what you're doing. When you have that powerful, tight connection, you are therefore motivated to make change because your actions will directly influence the outcomes. We have a whole set of theological convictions that sever that tie, that mean I don't need to make change because it's not me that makes the difference, it's God who gives the growth. And so I don't have an urgency to make a change because I have a theological disposition that says what I do doesn't make that difference, really. It's God. It's the soil. And so in the book, I try and wrestle with that theological issue that I think is fundamental for us. But you've also got other issues. You've got ministry, preaching week by week is an emotional experience.
Mm.
We were talking earlier about Monday.
You come in here.
Yeah, Mondays
you just feel pooped.
Mondays are hard. And so I wake up on a Monday after a big Sunday, and change requires emotional investment, and I don't have much on a Monday. And so there's particular features of our ministry that make it difficult. Working with volunteers, change is a resource-rich thing. It requires lots of investment.
Yeah, you had a line, managing volunteers and leading them through change is far more challenging than leading employees through change. And I thought, oh, intuitively I agree, but I want to read more about why you think that's the case.
Oh, yeah. Totally the case. No one in business thinks so, but our task is the much harder one.
And they're just going to scoff at us when they hear us say that.
Well, I'll give you some thoughts why it's so. It's change requires close investment in the life of a person. When I've got an employee who's in the business, who's in the workplace 40 hours a week, I can work with them on change day in, day out until the change begins to develop and grow. I can get the teams together, you know, 5 days a week to work it all through. When I'm working with volunteers, particularly in a suburban context, I think university ministry is different to suburban ministry, and that's one of the other issues we have to wrestle with. But in a suburban context, I only have volunteers 4, 5, 6 hours a week if they're motivated. And so the ability to actually get alongside them, produce change, is much trickier because I've only got a few hours to speak to it, and then they're back again. They're off into their other world. And then I have a few hours to work with them. They're back into their world again. And so it's the difference between training dogs and training cats. You know, the dog, I can keep doing the exercise and say, walk, stop, until they get it. Cats have gone. They're off. Churches are more like cats than dogs. you know what I mean? People are off. They've got a whole other life. We only have short windows with them to produce the change. And if they're not captivated by the need for change, if the leader isn't and they're not, then they're not going to give me the time and investment to make it work either. So the whole thing comes back to heart, you see. It comes back to us as leaders cultivating within the whole congregational setting. We have to do something about this. And the conversation about soil repeatedly cuts the nerve of that energy for change.
Thanks so much for coming in. Andrew Hurd has been our guest on The Pastor's Heart. He is the Senior Minister of EV Church and leads the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches. He's the author of this new book, Growth and Change, which I hope you'll read. And we've put the link to purchase it in the show notes. We will look forward to your company next Tuesday afternoon.
Hey, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we would love it if you could hop over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating and review. That helps us in the rankings and lets other people discover The Pastor's Heart. And again, if you are able to help us out by being a financial partner, go to our Patreon link, patreon.com/thepastorsheart.